Welcome to The Brainstorm, episode 118. Today, we're going to kick it off. SpaceX, XAI, Tesla, all of them merging, some of them merging, we'll see. And then we're going to dive into Alpha Genome from Google. All right, so to kick this off, there have been lots of rumors of SpaceX IPO, but then there were lots of rumors of SpaceX merging with XAI. And then there were rumors of SpaceX merging with Tesla and or XAI. I think, and you know, we discussed this with the entire team, Tasha, Daniel, Brett. It seems like our consensus is that it's most likely or most sensible for a merger with XAI.
Is it most likely or most sensible or both?
I think the prediction markets suggest that it is the most likely. So that's what I'm going off of there.
What about sensibility? Sense and sensibility.
Yes, sensibility.
Elon has confirmed this. He said it's very likely. And they're in advanced talks.
Yeah.
Why? Sensibility-wise, Sam? I think it makes a lot of sense. Right? Okay. For
justify
XAI.
It.
Okay. Nick's skeptical. This we're on the right track.
Brett's skeptical as well.
We're on the right track. Okay. So why is it sensible? You have launch capability. You have a need for solar. You have a need for compute, and you have a need for selling that capability or offering some service off of it. Tesla. I won't say Tesla. Elon has always recognized and I think been extremely good at vertical integration, which is necessary to push the frontier of industries. And I think there is no difference here where, you know, this is pushing the frontier, not of an industry, it's pushing the frontier of the final frontier. And so this vertical integration is, you know, pretty critical, I think. I also think it's extremely cash intensive to get this flywheel up and spinning. And so having all of the efficiencies possible and having all of the funding be straightforward and, you know, directed towards this one effort make the most sense, given that this is, I think, the biggest opportunity out there, as opposed to kind of bifurcated efforts along the way.
I think the core kind of business logic here is the foundation model companies, call them XAI, OpenAI, Anthropic, and Google, Gemini, are all realizing that the way to differentiate is to continue to accrue more compute. You need more compute to train your models, to like generate the next set of kind of like capabilities of these things, and to service your existing customers with those capabilities. And so kind of your ability to compete is effectively gated by how much compute you have access to. Now, unfortunately, that means like if you want a lot of compute right now, you have to borrow a lot of money because the companies are broadly, it's not true for all of them, but generating cash flow sufficient for the amount they're spending on compute to service their customers, but not such enormous cash flow in excess that they can fund their compute clusters they need for R&D needs. And Elon's looking at the playing field and saying, well, you know, XAI on a monetization perspective is clearly not as successful with Anthropic and OpenAI as of now. But on a capability perspective, he can see clear to, I'm going to get, you know, on an incremental basis, more compute, which is going to deliver me more capability. And I think monetization is going to catch up. But then he's looking 2 and 3 years down the road and saying, actually, I need to line up also financing because I can get compute into the ground quicker than other people, which delivers me better capability. But I also need to line up financing to make sure I can get that 2 and 3 and 4 year compute plan built. And he's saying, actually, everybody's schedule for building out these data centers is super aggressive because having built car factories, he knows that it's like putting assets on the ground is just complex and challenging, and suddenly like the people that care about the owls in the forests of Germany are striking against your factory because you're trying to build it on top of the owls. And so he says, well, there are no owls in space, and I have this great launch vehicle. And as it turns out, you can do reasonable math to say AI compute in space should be probably cost competitive, maybe even actually cost advantaged if you make some reasonable inferences about how they can kind of like lower the cost of launch of rocket and lower the weight of the satellites per compute. And again, no owls. So you can do it kind of like you can copy and paste compute into space. And
well,
so
like on that note, not only copy and paste, they filed for 1 million of these satellites.
Yes. So one, how many satellites are orbiting Earth right now, Sam?
I believe there's roughly 9,000.
Yeah.
Or maybe that's so, just Starlink, right?
Right.
So it's like, maybe like, you know, I think SpaceX has 66% of them. So, you know, just over 12,000-ish.
So if you look at even like SpaceX before was going to do, you know, 40,000 satellites. Now they're going to do 9 or 1 million satellites, you know, 40,000 at peak. And that kind of roughly conforms to how we'd modeled it. Now they need 20x more-ish satellites, which also kind of roughly conforms to how we model the additional upmass they need to do. The majority of SpaceX's business becomes launching AI compute and then selling that back to probably XAI, but maybe XAI and Google or whoever else is willing to buy these tokens. And so if you don't merge the entities, then you end up in this weird thing where Elon is selling Elon services. How do you decide the pricing on those? Like, do you get more margin here or more margin there? And so it actually introduces some potentially challenging conflicts between the entities. And kind of like there's less ability for the entities to collaborate on exactly what that needs to look like. And so the reason to merge is in part because SpaceX is set up to IPO and so can raise a lot of capital to build out this AI compute business. XAI also needs a lot of capital over the next few years, so might as well like glom them together and raise even more against that combined entity. And then you don't end up with this kind of like transfer pricing kind of conflict where instead it can all stack up and you save all that margin and you get it downstream at you're able to charge the customers, you know, less for better service or provide them better service at the same price with better margins. And so, you know, ultimately end up competitive against the rest of the industry because you own effectively all the way through the end of the data center, which all these companies are trying to do. It's just the other ones are trying to do it through JVs, for instance, OpenAI with the SoftBank JV, where they own the infrastructure, but they're using SoftBank as a financing arm. This is a similar type arrangement, but there's full vertical integration, and it's with a rocket launch company to put AI compute in space.
And then for context, also over the weekend, or just this morning, Amazon asking the FCC for an extension for they have to get their 1,600 satellites up into orbit by the middle of the year. Otherwise, there's like a use it or lose it type regulation. And Amazon is saying there's not enough launch capability. And meanwhile, you have SpaceX saying we want to put 1 million satellites into orbit ASAP. So don't sleep on the critical importance of launch capability. But Brett, I do want to ask you, so over the weekend, this is Aaron Burnett of Mach 33. You know, he, in response to the filing, he says, okay, 100 gigawatts of AI inference, to which Elon replies saying, most of training is inference for the purpose of training. So these work for a majority of training workload too.
Yeah, I mean, not for pre-train. So when you train a model, you pre-train it, which is what we're doing in these big contiguous data centers. You take all of this information, you embed it into weights. But kind of like to make them very performant, you have to do reinforcement learning, which is, you know, imagine the model having dialogue with itself, like Socratic dialogue to figure out kind of like, you know, how to derive fundamental math theorems and stuff. And so an easy way to think about this is how do we train kind of like the robotaxi system? Well, you know, first you like throw in a bunch of driving data, but then you stick the robotaxi in a simulator that it's generating itself and it tries out different things. And it's like, oh, this results in an accident, this doesn't in this particular situation. So you can imagine the inference compute can serve as kind of like the simulation engine for the world, for these things to explore kind of the simulated world so that they're much better in the real world. And so there is like a, now I think that there's, there still are some constraints on latency and stuff. Like, I'm not sure exactly how much of the reinforcement learning you could do in space versus still needing to have data centers on the ground. But broadly, I would say the mix of training is moving much more towards inference than it was before.
Okay, what? Sorry. Wait,
one last thing, because the other side of this that we just ignored because we said it's not sensible, but I think it's worth explaining why not. And Brett, I thought you made this point quite well, which is, you know, as Tesla shareholders, there's this, I think, kind of tension, because a lot of these people want to partake in the exciting things that Elon is doing and want to be rewarded for being long-term shareholders and so get access to SpaceX in some way. But it's like, would actually doing a merger with Tesla undersell what those shareholders are holding on to?
Yeah. So my view is that Tesla has relatively obvious, forecastable, like lump of, we think, in extreme cash flows that are going to come from robotaxi. You know, this is based on all the work that Sam, you, and Tasha and Daniel have done on kind of like the potential of the robotaxi business. They're just commercializing. And because it's a publicly traded entity, it's not really getting credit for that. In fact, you could say it's pretty explicitly not getting credit for what seem to be pretty obvious operating cash flows that'll come into the business, you know, at extreme scale. And so trading Tesla equity for SpaceX equity, where SpaceX is being given a fair amount, I would say much more credit on its future cash flows than Tesla is, at least in the kind of like near immediate forecastable term, I would think would be not a fair exchange. So I would prefer, it's possible down the road, you still end up with this complex web where Tesla is producing chips that's going into the SpaceX, you know, satellites that are powering the XAI AI systems. Tesla, it's a little unclear to me who's producing the solar for the satellites. That might be SpaceX is spinning up its own factory, but Tesla has a lot of solar manufacturing capability that they're spinning up right now. You know, the XAI model is going to go into the Optimus bots and the is already in the autonomous robo-taxis as kind of like the reasoning engine that goes on top. So it would not be inconceivable that ultimately these are going to become a single entity. I think I would, you know, as a Tesla shareholder, I'd prefer to get like fair value for the robo-taxi business before kind of trading that or exchanging that equity with these other entities.
All right, Nick, floor is yours. Let the smirks come.
Yeah, there's a lot of ands, ifs, and a lot of other hopes and prayers in these explanations. But I guess my question is, what percent of total AI compute do you think gets shot into space versus what is ground-based? Because, I mean, you can, I completely defer to you, Brett, Sam, the entire team, Daniel, Tasha, Frank, Joseph, everyone that's doing work on it. But from, let's call myself an outsider's perspective, maybe it's just more simple to explain this as in SpaceX has a valuation problem. If they want to go public, they're going to try and get a $1.5 trillion IPO tag, and they're doing around $15 billion in revenue. So that's 100x revenue. XAI has a funding issue because they need to raise incrementally more funding each and every round, which is, you know, we're now talking about $40, $50 billion rounds for these AI labs. Yet their Grok adoption is probably the worst in the industry, and it's low single digits. So you can solve two problems at once by combining the entity. You get the AI premium tag for SpaceX, and then you also get funding from SpaceX into XAI because there's a more sustainable business in Starlink and rocket launches.
So I think I take issue with the first point. I don't think SpaceX would have a problem floating the proposed valuation given, because think about it. I know you're like, gosh, it's 100 times revenue, but they have a decade plus advance on the industry. And they have, like, Starlink itself is a license to print money. As in, if you look at because, you know, who's launching the competing low Earth orbit satellite service? Sam was just talking about the fact that Amazon's having trouble, you know, hitting this deadline to get 1,600 birds up, which I totally believe, because they don't really have, like, a, you know, a high frequency launch vehicle they can use, and SpaceX is using all its own capacity. And so from the perspective of, like, not just, hey, this is the trailing, you know, revenue this company has, but from the, like, this is how much capital the company is going to deploy, and then the ROIC on that capital, and then whether or not you end up with net present value well in excess of the current valuation, you can, look at our work and
I think you
come to that conclusion.
I think
pretty easily
the case that it's not overvalued. I think the public markets as a whole are a bit more, call it fundamental and backwards looking than the private markets. So as much as our research might point towards $1.5 trillion being cheap, I don't know that you're going to get that tag in the public markets when they're not growing at
Nick, 100. Are you shorting SpaceX on the launch?
I'm trying to provide a different perspective so that the viewers understand that we're not a part of the Elon Musk cult and that there is some semblance of disagreement on
No, but I really don't I really t- I do not think that SpaceX get like the fact that the AI compute opportunity is there means that kind of like the prospective value, you know, they go from a 40,000 satellite constellation to a million satellite constellation. So there's, and like, if you adjust for upmass, it's probably, you know, in our work, maybe 50 plus X the amount of kind of like upmass you have to send up there. If they're selling that compute to a separate entity, to XAI or Google, then that means that, the launch vehicle provider has an opportunity that's, you know, of that order larger than we previously thought. And so there's plenty of scope if you accept the fact that somebody's going to buy the compute on the back end to justify the valuation.
Right.
They
so
don't need
to
combine
Nick's second
them.
Point. Yeah, Nick's second point touches on that, which is, okay, Grok, Imagine was pretty great, you know, but in terms of market share adoption, very low. You obviously need capital to stay in the game and keep making amazing models. But as you just alluded to, right, all of this is assuming that someone wants to pay for it. And so who's paying for it? Who's the customer?
Right. So, and I think that is a more, call it valid critique here. It's, hey, Elon needs financing for XAI, not SpaceX. SpaceX is totally financeable, but XAI, you know, so far they've raised a ton of money. You know, Elon can typically raise a lot of money. I would say that it's undeniable that certainly OpenAI and ChatGPT and Gemini on the kind of like user side has more users. And then on the monetization side, though, Claude has like a much smaller number of users. They have like good enterprise penetration and so are monetizing even quicker than OpenAI's business. You can imagine you can wager on kind of like enterprise direct productivity growth is going to continue and Anthropic's still going to be able to hit that market. And so Anthropic will grow. You can bet on, well, just like aggregate user attention, adoption, and the most used, most token generating model is going to give somebody an angle on continuing to grow monetization. And that's why OpenAI and ChatGPT is going to win. You can bet on, well, just having all the incumbent advantage of I have like default distribution through Chrome and I have Gmail and stuff, then that's why Google's going to win. Or you can bet the person who has access to the most compute the quickest is going to win, and that's why you would bet on XAI. But like you said, Wall Street doesn't like to say, hey, forward looking, this company is going to have the most compute, therefore I'm going to give them credit. They like to see, you know, the revenue and not just Wall Street, but also when you get to a certain class of like raising large sums of capital, that becomes increasingly important. And so I think that kind of providing XAI with SpaceX as a fundraising vehicle is also an important consideration here, because I do think over measured backward looking, almost definitionally, the company that has access to the most compute will have won, right? But getting access to the most compute means you have to like convince people to give you money to buy that compute. And so that's like, you know, the move that Elon is making with SpaceX and XAI is trying to ensure they get access to that future compute, betting that monetization will follow.
It is also interesting because if there is a hiccup in the great acceleration, I actually think this positions XAI / SpaceX far better than, say, someone like OpenAI. It's like Gemini, I think, is fine. They've got a business, whatever. But it's like OpenAI is really solely based on, hey, this thing's up and to the right. Give us tons of money. We're going to do it. I think Anthropic has some more endurance in terms of enterprise usage. But it's like if there is a hiccup and it's not up and to the right, people are spending tens to hundreds of billions of dollars funding, then it's like, okay, there's a pause. That gives time for all of the development. And then it's like when the race picks up, they're there ready to send things into space rapidly. Because it's like, I think it's like if it is up and to the right, then it's like, okay, the time it takes to get the chips and everything into space is disadvantaged relative to terrestrial. But if you're looking at like true grand scale, obviously, I think the space option.
You're saying like space over a medium time, call it 10-year time frame, it's very bettable that there's a larger volume of AI compute in space than on the ground. But over a 5-year time frame, there's so much sensitivity to do they get Starship reusable in time, you know, and stuff that kind of like terrestrial continues to outpace, even on a growth basis, space compute. It's probable. So it's like, and Nick, to your question, like how much is on the ground versus in space? If you take Elon's plans at rough face value, you end up with roughly equivalent, more on the ground, but you know, SpaceX catching up in the 2030 to 2031 timeframe. I think that actually Google still being here and trying to compete is really important to this XAI SpaceX entity, because if XAI can't monetize, you have to have somebody that buys that incremental compute from you. And I think Google will be a natural buyer. Like all of the, everybody's going to run into this constraint, and they already are, of we don't have enough computers to serve our customers, you know? And so the protection built into this model is just the idea that there will be really big buyers of compute that are out there, and they could be Google, Anthropic, OpenAI, for reasons that I'm sure you can imagine. It's hard for me to fathom OpenAI buying computers from Elon. I just don't think he would sell them to them. So then I think that, but I think Google very much could, and it even could be SpaceX is launching Google TPUs and selling them back to Google as an operating, you know, entity for those computers.
What happens to the thesis here if we take the lens of the Gavin Baker viewpoint, which is we're going to offload a lot of compute and run it locally on device, as in we carry around a ton of compute with us at all times. Why not just run most of the queries through a locally stored model? What happens then? Do we need all of these computers flying around in space?
Well, you still need to train the model somehow, but even on the inference side, it's kind of like, what is it? There's like some story where it's like the kid goes out and trades like, you know, a quarter for two dimes, and then trades two dimes for three nickels. You were told this, and then trades three nickels for 5 cents and comes back to his dad. It's like, look at this five. I traded one for five. Aren't you so proud of me? And his dad just shakes his head, closing his eyes. And he's like, I knew he was proud, right? That's going to be your experience when you turn like an AI agent loose with your little digital wallet running on a local machine, and it gets eaten alive by like an actually smart, you know, device that's out there. So yeah, if you like, I think an underpowered, you know, operating live AI agent is going to be an enormous
liability.
security risk if it's if it's not you know, not at the cutting edge. And so the utility will get off these things will be in part because they are at the frontier of capability of these things operating in the wild. So yes, you can create little gimmicky things that you'll have running on your device, but it's not going to be where the economic value lies.
Well, it'll be fine for us humans because it's like, okay, we don't want to be interacting with, you know, 250 IQ beings, but our phone operating at, you know, 120 IQ telling us useful things that seem great to us is fine. But then when it goes interacts with other AI agents, it has to up its game. But all of this, okay, we talked about all of this. This is really one big topic, and maybe we'll do two sentences because Tesla also had earnings last week. And I think it's pretty poetic that they're shutting down the S&X factory and using it to build robotics, because it's like up until now, Tesla has become what it is by making human-driven electric vehicles. And it's like that era is over, right? And in true Tesla fashion, they're putting their chips back on the table and they're saying human-driven EVs are a dead-end business and we are now an autonomous company, both in terms of vehicles and in terms of robotics. Simultaneously, energy, still a connecting theme across all of it, huge investments in solar, and supply chain resilience was like another big theme.
And they're doing dry electrodes. They're investing, they announced, they're basically doubling their CapEx year over year, right? Or even more.
Up to 20 now.
Yeah. So that's another sign of like, they think they're getting great ROI on vertical integration. And I think this is contrarian. I think, they're going to come back to the X as in, yes, they're going to shut down the factory. They're going to put Optimi in there. They're going to get their robotaxi business up and spinning, and they're going to need like a luxury robotaxi that people can call at a higher price point. And they will, the X, maybe an X without front passenger seats. It's just like, you know, you open the Falcon Wing doors and sit in the back of this kind of like amazing thing. They will bring it back at some point in the future to hit the high end kind of like luxury market.
Yep. And I think Elon even tweeted as much saying no longer sold to passengers, but they'll probably still be part of the fleet.
Yeah.
All right. Topic two. Brett, this is yours to set up.
Sure. Alpha Genome it helps to have like a little understanding of how genetics works here. Basically, we all have a shared common, or we all have a recipe for our own body in each of our cells, and that recipe is your genome. And you know, you start out with it, and it kind of like tells your body how to build itself. And the Google or DeepMind, which is Google's AI unit, announced Alpha Genome. And what Alpha Genome does is it takes, the genome is composed of 3 billion base pairs. So these are one of 4 different letters. And kind of like the combination of letters determines the proteins that you generate that make your body run. Alpha Genome can take million long snippets of your genome and determine kind of like the output RNA and ultimately proteins that are going to be generated from that, and determine kind of like what happens if there's a mutation here or a variant here and how it impacts kind of the downstream molecules that get generated. So take your 3 billion base pairs. For a long time, people were like, well, actually 3 billion base pairs doesn't really matter because it's really the exome that matters. And the exome is, there are certain like recipes or certain like instructions in your genome that are like, generate a protein now. And then it goes through and reads those letters off. And then there's another one that's the stop that says, okay, stop generating the protein. And so that generates RNA, which ultimately goes downstream into protein. And so people thought that actually, and only 2% of the genome is that protein coding region. And that's known as the exome. So people thought, well, the exome is the most important thing because this is where the genomes are generated. Everything else is kind of like, we don't really know what it does. I'm sure it's not important, right? As it turns out, it's important. And so what Alpha Genome does is help to interpret how it's important, as in kind of, yes, you go through and generate the protein in this region, but there's all this other instructions over here that changes exactly what protein or in what to what degree it's generated, exactly what isoform of protein is generated. And so Google or DeepMind figured out how to read not just the exome, but all of the, or predictively read the full stretch of genome. And so the first order consequence, I would say, is some diagnostic companies, they will do exome sequencing, where they're just sequencing that 2% of the protein coding region, being like, well, we figured out what any errors in there are going to be the errors that affect the body downstream. But whole genome is now more valuable because you can tell what all of that junk DNA, which isn't actually junk, actually does prospectively to the body. And so from a very high level, it means that, you know, you could have a 50x increase in marginal demand for core sequencing because you're going from only exomes being valuable, and this isn't, you know, this is speaking very crudely, but to genome, the whole genome being more valuable than it was before.
I feel like in true fashion of a lot of these topics, it's like, oh my God, this is incredible. But what does it mean? It's like, okay, more people are going to get sequenced, and then what? It's like, or it's like, okay, this isn't the final piece of the puzzle. It's like,
no.
We finished the border of the puzzle, and now we can fill in the pieces.
Yeah, I'm not even the border. It's like you found a few edge pieces, I think. You got a corner edge piece. You're like, oh, and these two fit together. I think it's a tool that will prove useful for a lot of different companies and service providers in a lot of different circumstances. Right now, it's only for research use only. So they have surfaced it via API, but you can't commercially license it. DeepMind has I think it's Isomorphic Labs, which is like their kind of owned and operated commercial entity that probably will get the first commercial license here, but they'll probably also license it out to drug developers who can use it to, you know, be smarter about kind of like how they develop drugs to go after specific diseases. Generally, like the use of AI in drug development, we think is going to reduce the cost of bringing a drug to market by 75% and the time to get a drug to market by 40%. For those using it right. And we'll begin to realize that over the course of this decade. And these kinds of tools are the kinds of tools that should and could make that happen. If you can figure out what's going to happen before you're operating in the lab, your odds of succeeding are much better than if you're kind of like just throwing darts. And the industry, even like the highest class versions of drug development, looks a lot still like throwing darts in a lot of circumstances. And so I think that this is like, yes, another like layer of the onion slightly peeled back, but biology is so massively complex and we have very little understanding of what's going on given its complexity.
All right. Other honorable mention topics: Moltbook, agents and humans pretending to be agents, posting lots of interesting things. Anything else?
One last one. Meta earnings.
Oh, also Gemini, the world's three, Genie 3.
Oh yeah, Genie 3. That didn't Genie that cause all the. Cool.
All right,
okay, so Meta. Did. The... Okay, go on ahead of Meta. Yeah.
I think what's interesting about Meta is you could make a reasonable assumption that Meta, through its, call it merchant advertising products that are tied to AI, plus all of the incremental advantages it's getting now, just on engagement across its family of apps, is probably doing the most revenue tied to AI than any other company.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking their click to chat ads on WhatsApp, where it's like, I'm a business, I have like a user facing interface and I can advertise, hey, you can chat to, you know, this salesperson or whatever. The fact that you can power the chat back end with an AI tool that's increasingly performant makes those much more valuable potential ad units than they were before. Before, like, to do it, you had to have like somebody staffed there, and you know, who knows how good that person is. Now, at least you can measure how good the person is, and because it's an agent, and it can be potentially much more effective. And then as that agent becomes more effective, then that click to chat ad gets better ROI because the person you're feeding into the channel, you have better chance of like completing the sale or making the customer service success. So it is an interesting format for the AI age.
Yeah.
And up 50% year over year in the US.
Yeah. And they're doing, you know, other notables. They're on a $10 billion revenue run rate for Gen AI video creation tied to their advertising platform. So like, there's just multiple different ways to look at this story and say, wow, they actually really did nail AI, just not in the way that other companies have approached it. It's more folding it into the core business and seeing the growth explode. Because if you look at the numbers, it's actually pretty incredible. They grew 24% in this past quarter, and they're guiding Q1 to 30%. I mean, on the revenue base that they have, which is anywhere from 45 to 50 billion a quarter, that's a success story of AI right there in front of you that most people will gloss over.
Okay, quick question, because Nick, this ties into a topic you tweeted about, you X'd about last week, which is, and it seems pretty clear what you're just saying with Meta, with Moltbook, right? It's like the internet is for bots, right? It's like, I think we're in the next 3 years, we're crossing the chasm where it's like, originally it was created to connect humans who know each other together. Then we're currently, I think, at the tail end of the phase of connecting humans with people they don't know, but content they find interesting. And then the next wave is it's just connecting humans with AI generated bots, friends, videos, etc. Okay, so those are the three phases. Is there room for OG internet to come back?
I don't know.
Connecting people to people.
I think there is, but I think
it's such a small business.
In real life. Like, I am actually incredibly excited about in real life type events again for the first time. Like, I think we've been in this general trend of like increasing consumption and screen time. But I think we will, as like the internet just becomes a giant slot machine for AI content, I think a good portion of the population will go outside and touch grass more often, which will be great. But their hours spent on the internet will be monetized at a much higher rate because you'll be able to personalize the experience X amount better than it currently is. So the numbers may not look like, oh, the internet is falling apart. It just might be that people value their time not being inundated with AI content 90% of the time when they're online. Like, there's going to be, I think, a real inflection point of what is this content, real or AI? And like verification, the WorldCoin thesis, like all of that, I think, is starting to become more attractive. Like, I think you will have to verify humanness on the internet within a few years, if not even sooner. Like, it's just happening at an incredible pace. But I think part of the way people will deal with it is potentially just not spending as much time online. That's my optimistic view for the world. I don't know.
So they'll go to movies. Should we be pro box office here?
Like, I think you can go.
Movies are the least social thing you could do.
Okay, let's go one layer deeper, which is like, that was like my optimistic take. Like, people will somehow unaddict themselves to these like massively addictive platforms, which I just don't fully believe. Like, that's just me being hopeful for humanity. The other way to view this is the recommendation algorithm that the Metas of the world run become increasingly more valuable because they determine, you know, how much time you spend. So their decision to show you AI versus not AI versus your friends versus a content creator, like, that increasingly becomes extremely valuable. So like the premium video platforms that decide, like, curation itself might come wildly back into play because you just have to deal with so much more content. So like, you can look at it one way of like, oh, there's just going to be so much, but if these companies nail the recommendation algorithm, you won't actually see a lot of it and your experience might not change that much at all.
It reminds me of the cigarette industry where it's like, you got these people generating all of this stuff. They don't want their kids to use it. And then it's like, what's the pitch? It's like, oh, we're going to do vapes. And it's like, oh, that's way better than smoking, except for it's way more addictive. And hey, now kids can do it too.
Yeah. I mean, like, as much as I want to cringe at the idea of like scanning my eyeball to get on a social media platform, a la the rumors around OpenAI and like a human social media platform, I do think there is a lot of merit in that idea. I just don't believe that scanning your eyeball is the right way. We have Face ID. It's very easy.
I don't know. I mean, it's like there's some assumption that humans are intrinsically valuable to interact with. And in my experience with a lot of them, it's not. So it's kind of like,
we're honored you show up. We're honored you show up to the show.
As in like, if you're interacting with the thing digitally anyway, like, what does it matter? Like, I believe in real life stuff, right? But kind of like the fact that, oh, this is an authentically human idiotic post as opposed to an AI generated idiotic post, it's still going to be an idiotic post. So like, what do I care? Do you know what I mean? So,
all right, there you have it. Value your time with people, or if they're stupid, then who cares?
Stupid people can be entertaining too. It's not just like a stupid, it's kind of, yeah. I just don't know, the marginal kind of like digital figment versus the marginal like human, it's not necessarily true that you would rather like get the input from the human. And actually maybe it will be decreasingly true over time.
But friendship. It's like, but let's take what you said. It's like, you can have a friend who's like an okay friend, and it's like, well, maybe you'd rather have like a decent AI friend. Well, yeah. But
Sam, I think the one thing that goes against that is the vast majority of time spent on social media platforms is actually not engaging with your friends' content.
No, that's what I'm saying. We're already past that phase. Yeah, I'm saying there's, I think there could be a reintroduction of,
I think it comes
value out of that.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. But we'll, and then that's the whole point. What do I, if I'm already engaging with anonymous strangers' content, what do I care if it's an AI anonymous stranger or just like a stranger anonymous stranger?
Right. Well, that's why I think phase three, as I described it, is inevitable, right? It's like we're going from seeing strangers' posts to AI posts. And it's like, I agree, there's no difference between those two.
Well, it'll become indistinguishable too.
Yeah.
That's the scary part. Where you
But why is that scary? I mean, it's no, the stranger is also scary, I guess. It's like, why is AI scarier than the stranger?
I mean, Sam didn't go into the later half of my tweet, which is like social media has been a very powerful force and a net benefit to society, but it also comes with like a lot of dangers and it's very polarizing. And the type of engagement that, you know, is amplified is usually like crazy and outlandish takes that just continue to push people's like perception of reality further and further from the truth. Like, we don't have a central source of truth anymore, and that's partly because of social media and the way that these algorithms monetize your engagement. And so, like, you have potential bad actors coming in, and they're able to manipulate the algorithms and make you feel like, yeah, this is what everyone thinks about X topic, when the majority of those people are actually AI bots. Like, that is where it becomes extremely scary. And I don't know how you revert back. Like, we're already way past the chasm I'm describing. Like, we're heading down a bad path anyway. I don't know how it gets any better. It only exacerbates the problem when you have an increased amount of content.
Well, Nick, you said truth, so that'll probably catch people. But let's just say, it's like we used to have one story. Whether it was true or not, there's one story that everyone accepted as the story because that's all there was.
Right.
And now there's like infinite stories where it's hard to, if someone's in their own storyline, it's very hard to get them to a different storyline.
Yeah. Truth is just one example of the type of content you can go after. You can go after just pure entertainment. But again, that just continually fragments people's perception of reality, because when you feel that you're in a community, you feel like this is what everyone's talking about and caring about. And the reality is you're just like in a weird sub niche genre of content that really no one cares about. And so then you start to distance yourself from like the actual, like what is actually happening in the world. It's very bad.
All right. Everyone can circle back next week for therapy. And in the meantime, I'm sure more things will happen. But we're going to
know if it's uniformly bad. But,
okay. No, it's a double edged. The way that I describe it is a double edged sword. I'm just giving you bits and takes of the.
It's like the history of civilization is basically allowing more and more people to glom together without killing each other, right? And the narratives we tell about things, like even if you go back from going to like, I can't remember what the subcategories are, but tribe to something larger than tribe, it's like you have to have a religion that instills that there are ancestors that like trace you back so that you don't kill this person you're not related to because there's a shared ancestor that you both believe in. That shared ancestor becomes, you know, a god or whatever. And, you know, and then you install a system of laws. And it's all in the interest of like allowing people to live at density without killing each other. Well, what technology is now doing is it's allowing us to disaggregate, to no longer live in density with a lot of people, but still be as productive. Like you can be increasingly atomic, and like the zero person company or the one person company, the reason that can be done is you can inexpensively carve these like commercial interfaces out, channels around who you are with all of these service providers in a very frictionless way. And so then it means that like, practically, you can't know more than 100 people. Why are you friends with 5,000 people on the internet? You're not, you know, you're friends with like, you know, some tens of people, right? And it's actually extraordinarily kind of misleading to have this idea that, hey, I can be in kind of like this proximate dense relationship with this other person where it's impractical for me to do so. So maybe it's more honest to allow people to like atomize and kind of like isolate into whatever reality bubble they have. And then you just have like interfaces that are carved very well between them so that this reality doesn't get in the way of that reality and they kill each other. And so I think that's where we're
at. The problem is, are you
like Jim Barksdale said, there's only two ways to survive in civilization.
But are you actively choosing to be a part of that reality, or are you just slowly being nudged towards it by the algorithm? Like that's the, and it's like, again, it's a double-edged sword where yes, it makes a lot of problems a lot easier because you can, you know, find that community and solve problems, but also at the same time, it makes solving collective problems a lot harder when the content that gets the most reach are usually the most polarizing views, because that's what gets people angry, enraged, and then they interact with it. Like when you see just like a middle of the road take, you just gloss over it because you're like, yeah, of course, that's what everyone. But you start hearing conspiracy. Like, look at the growth of conspiracy theories on the internet. It's not because, like, you know, they're true. It's because the algorithms push it because people find it fascinating. But it slowly nudges you towards a very dystopian reality that might actually end up hurting society.
All right, we've tried to end this multiple times. Let's end it here. All right.
To be
See everyone next week.
ARK Investment Management LLC is an SEC registered investment advisor. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public are separate, unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to any company marketing or selling the products or services of the others. ARK, Wolf Financial, and Public make no representation or warranties regarding and expressly disclaim any responsibility or liability for any acts, omissions, losses, or damages of the other entities or their affiliates, officers, employees, or agents. No company shall be liable for any indirect, incidental, consequential, or special damages arising out of or in connection with this podcast or its contents. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK, and investors should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and or show guests, and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statement. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily,
have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARC believes to be reliable. However, ARC does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.